This is a recording of the session of the Football Scholars Forum held on February 26, 2013 via Skype. The discussion turned on three works: Stephen Apostoloff's article on Massachusetts soccer history, Gabe Logan's chapter on Chicago soccer in the 1910s, and Tom McCabe's chapter from a new book manuscript on Northern New Jersey soccer. David Kilpatrick, freshly minted as official historian of the New York Cosmos, moderated the discussion. The recording begins in progress with Stephen Apostoloff speaking.
Players were different on the Eastern Coast as compared to players in the Midwest. I would like to talk a little bit about my recent findings. By the way, I'm trying to reshuffle the dissertation and to publish it as a book. My last chapter of the dissertation was titled From Pelé's Cosmos to Beckham's Galaxy. And the new one that I'm writing, it's titled Beyond Beckham's Galaxy. I was fascinated as a kid from Star Wars movies. And in my last chapter, actually, I would like to among the recent findings, actually, there is evidence of smuggling of players through the Canadian border in the 1920s. So I would really like to sit down and develop this more, because I think it's the first evidence of human trafficking in soccer that started here in the United States. In about the last chapter, Beyond Beckham's Galaxy, I would like to sit down and analyze the impact of video games, notably of FIFA soccer, on the development of MLS. Nobody has done this. There are very few papers about video games and the impact on sports. And what is really interesting, the interesting thing is that FIFA soccer is the most sold, actually, sports game in the United States. It goes, it's better sold than NFL and NBA plays. This is the land of the NBA and NFL. I would like to conclude with a couple of thoughts about the archives of the National Soccer Hall of Fame down in Carolina. David had the opportunity to go there and explore them. And I think that he said that there was a lot of things, and it's better to have four hands instead of two hands. It's even better to have six hands. And if somebody's interested, probably can go down there and work all together for a couple of days. Something says to me that there are some hidden treasures. And perhaps we can talk about that with Brian, who was actually able to go to the National Soccer Hall of Fame when it was still in Orlando, New York. So that's it about from me. I'll pass the word to Peter.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. And I should say that Stephen should be credited for the idea to have this session on U.S. soccer history, because he contacted Alex and me a few months ago, that was the seed that was planted originally, and we didn't know what form it would take. So it's great that we have three authors and three papers to discuss.
It was, by the way, Stephen's. Peter, it was born, actually, it was David and I brainstorm every now and then. David should be credited for this, too.
Okay, thanks for that. And Gabe Logan, the ball is passed to you now.
Okay, I'll try not to cough it up. Hope everybody's doing well. And Steve, it's good to hear from you especially, and it's a pleasure to read your work in English as opposed to French. Your dissertation gave my mind quite the workout. As you all read, my paper deals with Chicago soccer in the Progressive Period, 1910 to 1920. Currently, I'm using this chapter to explore ideas of what is the American soccer player. If we're looking at all these players, they're agents in history, in that they're dealing with the tail end of the century of immigration in the United States, the Progressive Period, the labor movements in the city of Chicago. And so from this perspective, they're operating and they're living and they're moving in circles of United States history in the narrative. And why do they become something other than American when they take the field? As Steve pointed out, I think in the Midwest there's a little bit of a different picture in that the East Coast leagues tend to be more immigrant dominated, where in Chicago and especially St. Louis and even Milwaukee and some of the Ohio cities, it was sometimes 50-50 with native-born players. So that's the first thing I'm looking at. What is an American soccer player? And then secondly, in the following up chapter that came out of my dissertation, I'm looking at the labor sport union clubs from 1928 to 1936. And this was a communist soccer league in the United States. And while it was marginalized, it was quite strong. And it had very successful leagues in Detroit, in Chicago, in New York, in Philadelphia, pretty much the urban northeastern areas. And so I'm taking a closer look at those leagues and players. And then finally, when I signed up for Skype, they assigned me the number 9 at the end of my name. And I want to clarify, I am not now, nor I have ever been, a striker. And anybody that has played with me can attest to that. Okay, turning it back over to you, Pete.
Great stuff, Gabe. And coming in from northern New Jersey is Tom McCabe. Are you there, Tom? Ball to you.
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, clearly.
Okay. I've sat in a diner, a typical Jersey diner, right across the street from Clark Threadmill. It's Topps Diner. It's still there. And I'd imagine that John Harkes, Tony Meola, and Tab Ramos all sat there in the booths and had meals as they grew up and were playing soccer. Not sure they knew of the long thread of American history on that very soil and right across the street, dating back to the 1880s. They knew that soccer was a big part of Kearney and Harrison, Newark across the river, but I don't think they knew quite how important it was in the life of those three river towns. So the bit that you read is kind of a corporate history of Clark Thread Company that comes to Newark in the 1860s and expands across the river in the 1870s, 1880s. And soccer becomes part of the fabric of Kearney, Harrison, and Newark. The tentative title of the larger project is called The Cradle, From America's First Soccer Neighborhoods to the World Cup. And it's going to trace soccer in these three locales from the 1880s all the way to the 1990s when Tab and Tony and John all play in the World Cup, first in Italy in 90 and then here in the United States in 1994. My approach is a narrative one, looking at thick description of the towns, the soccer there, finding compelling characters to push that narrative around. Obviously, early on, it's quite difficult to find these characters, but they can be unearthed. And, you know, the approach, like the other two gentlemen, is to use the local as a window into the national scene and into American history further still. The source material to do that is available at the local level in a number of newspapers, census material, local histories. So essentially, I'm trying to make the argument that the story of U.S. soccer is really the story of Kearney, Harrison, and Newark. And, you know, expanding on Roger Alloway's work on the West Hudson by including Newark and trying to write, you know, as Toni Morrison says, if you really want to read a book that hasn't been written yet, then you have to write it. And I've known these places for a long time and looking to write the book that I'd like to read. Thank you, Peter.
Good stuff. David, over to you.
Well, I just want to thank first and foremost Peter and Alex for all their work on the Football Scholars Forum. Alex is either at the end of his flight to Buenos Aires or is just maybe passing through immigration right now, engaging in that next phase of his exciting research project for his dissertation, and Peter has been absolutely instrumental as a real leader in the field of football studies, and so I'm really, really honored and feel privileged to be invited to moderate this really important session on U.S. soccer history. This is, of course, a really important year for U.S. soccer history as the Federation celebrates its centennial, and this is also 100 years of the U.S. Open Cup, formerly the National Challenge Cup. So it's timely for us to have a session like this. 52 and a half, maybe 53 weeks ago, of course, we had a session dedicated to the film Once in a Lifetime, the documentary film about the New York Cosmos, my beloved New York Cosmos. And that session, of course, touched off an awful lot of really interesting concerns, and I think that's what triggered Stephen and I to really start talking about wanting to have this very session. So it's nice for this to be happening a year later. With that in mind, in that sense of history, we've got these three great papers that we're all to read tonight. Stephen Apostolov's Everywhere and Nowhere, The Forgotten Past and Clouded Future of American Professional Soccer from the Perspective of Massachusetts. Gabe Logan's Progressive Soccer, 1910-1919, looking at Chicago. And, of course, Tom McCabe's paper, Our New Thread, America's First Soccer Destiny. I also want to just point out very quickly, it was a nice present in my mailbox yesterday when the new copy of 11 arrived, and I opened it up and saw a great article from Tom on one of my heroes as a kid, the former player for Rangers and the Memphis Rogues, Hugh O'Neill. And Tom, I'm really grateful that you even quoted a line from one of my favorite songs as a kid. I could sing the entire song, but in the interest of time, I'll spare everyone that. Start off with this question for our three scholars who are featured tonight, but open it up for the discussion at large. Recently, Sepp Blatter triggered off a great deal of controversy here in the States when he criticized the progress or lack thereof for the professional game since the World Cup in 1994. That comment, of course, created a flurry of defensive posturing and rage towards the president of FIFA. But it could be that when there's such a reaction, such a provocation, is really the truth hurts. And so that statement and his pointing towards the 94 World Cup, and Tom has just alluded to key players from the West Hudson area who featured in the 94 World Cup. It begs a more historical perspective that fortunately these three authors today really give us, that this tradition, this history of American soccer goes back 100 years and even further back. And all three papers touch on that great legacy. But with Sepp Blatter's provocation in mind then, I'd like to, first of all, ask and invite our three authors to comment on how their research attempts to answer that question in terms of, we do have a long, rich history of soccer here, but why is it that the game has not gone over the top? In terms
Can it start?
Be a great
this
person.
This is Stephen.
Yeah.
Well, once again, there could be different answers because the situation, and this is actually something that I figured out in my last chapter, there is a huge difference on the Eastern Coast and the Western Coast. For instance, when you get up on the Eastern Coast, we watch Chelsea, watch Manchester. What do you watch after that, the New England Revolution? Well, I'm not going to ask you, Dave, about the New York Cosmos. You might be offended, but, you know, at least it's hard for me to watch the New England Revolution after that. And because of that, on the Eastern Coast, the TV ratings are pretty bad. And if the TV ratings are bad, then we won't really have investors and sponsors. On the other hand, on the Western Coast, when people get up, those games are already over. So if you know the score of a game, and don't tell me the score of El Clasico, there are more chances that you'll tune to the MLS games, and that's why the ratings of the Seattle Sounders are tremendous. Actually, ratings over there are equal, if not better, to ratings of baseball, or it's definitely better than NHL. Obviously, the Galaxy, they have good players, they have good following, good good ratings in a city like LA. So there is a tremendous difference between East and West Coast, and I think what it will eventually help MLS is the West Coast and some Canadian teams. And I think Sepp Blatter is totally right. There isn't a lot of progress in terms of professional soccer in the United States, and I think that basically the single entity of the league will save it. There are a couple of good teams, and you know they're kind of keeping afloat the other teams. So this was my comment. I can pass the ball to Gabe or to Tom.
I'll go ahead. This is Gabe, if it's okay. My research seems to indicate that when media, especially television in the United States, began to emphasize sports in the 50s and 60s, as well as it made for good drama. Unfortunately, there wasn't a professional league in soccer on a national level that was able to be featured. Further, capitalism in the market wouldn't allow for non-commercialized sports, where it's easily applied to basketball, baseball, hockey, and football. By the time of the NASL, United States television was having a quite difficult time trying to show a game in its entirety with the commercials, and I think that had a stunting effect on soccer on a mass popular level. However, it was still quite popular at the root level, at the base level, at the youth level. And then today, soccer, you have to pay for it to watch it on TV, and the other sports, that isn't quite the case. So it's still being crowded out, not to use Markovic's word, but it's being crowded out of the media market. That's why I don't think it's caught on with the mass public. And I'll turn it over at that point.
Tom, did you want to follow that up?
Yeah, sure. I'll share a couple thoughts briefly. You know, as a, I guess, part apologist and part gradualist, you know, this is taking time. When you look at the long, long history, which does exist, as David said, you know, over a century, I go back to Sunil Gulati's comments that, you know, modern U.S. soccer history probably starts in 1989. When you look at, you know, the growth of the game, television, factoring into the globality of soccer, you know, post 1989, when the U.S. qualifies for the World Cup and kind of reenters into this party of the World Cup, you know, things start to change. And when you look at it from the point of view of the last 25 years, I think the growth has been staggering on all sorts of levels. Blatter's comments, I interpreted them as ones made on MLS and the pro game. But there are a variety of experiences throughout the country. The Northwest certainly has added, you know, a tremendous amount to the fan experience. The level of play has ebbed and flowed, but I would make an argument that there are lousy games all over the globe, even in the EPL and La Liga. So, you know, to be snobs about the level of play, you know, I think you can point, you know, to games, you know, every Saturday, every Sunday around, you know, the world. And I think as historians, you know, we have to look at the long history, the big picture, and it's part show and part tell to let these people who have joined, you know, our tribe in the last 25 years know that it didn't start with the NASL, or God forbid, it didn't start with MLS or the World Cup in 1990. No, this goes way, way, way back, and that's why I was so happy to read these other papers.
There are some questions lined up. If I could just intervene for a moment, for those of you who are on Twitter, Lindsay is live tweeting the session, so you can also follow the discussion that way, and it can also be a back channel of conversation if you'd like. It's a great way to get people from outside the FSF to participate as well by retweeting and so on and so forth. So thanks, Lindsay, for doing this great service for the group.
Well, I'd like to just push a little further in terms of the papers that we were to read and comment, especially see if Gabe and Tom, if you you must have seen, as I did, this very interesting phenomenon of corporate paternalism and the role that it played in forging really strong teams in both Chicago and the West Hudson, Newark areas. And Stephen, I was wondering if maybe you could also chime in the degree to which corporate paternalism may have factored in the Boston scene at the time, if that was a factor with, say, the Fall River Marksmen or what have you back in the 1920s and 10s.
I'm sorry, David, I couldn't hear you very well. What was exactly your question?
Well, I was very struck by the thread of, no pun intended, with reference to Clark, but the threat of corporate paternalism in the formation of these soccer powerhouses in the 1910s and 20s.
Yeah, of course, this is a good point. For instance, as you know, they built the Fall River Marksmen, they built a stadium across the state border. Because of the blue laws, they couldn't sell any tickets on Sunday, and they built it in North Tiverton. And in order for people of Fall River to get there, they built actually a small electric train with which they were able actually to get on and to go to the stadium, which was just a few miles. But the stadium was built next to a factory. I don't know if you've ever seen it. The factory right now, it's an apartment building, actually. They have condominiums. But there was... There is an evidence of something else. Actually, there was a team in the north of Boston, the Shawshin Indians, the American Woolen Company. They got involved. They pulled this this team, and after the owner committed a suicide, they didn't have any funds. So there is a lot of evidence of corporate. Corporate involvement in the old American Soccer League in the 1920s.
Just a quick follow-up. I know, Peter, you've virtually raised your hand, but Stephen, when the Fall River Marksmen moved to New York to become the Yankees, didn't they then open the stadium up to local soccer since the stadium is in place? Wasn't there some kind of a gesture towards the community despite the team leaving?
This is a good point. I know that at some point one of the Chelsea players took over upon their return from New York because it didn't work out. And good question. I have to go through it to figure out. But yeah, later on, actually, it was a multiple purpose stadium. I think they were using it for to race like small cars and things like that. So there was a multiple. It was a multiple use facility, if you wish. It became after that.
Gabe, would you be able to tell us a little bit about that stadium that was built in Chicago?
Right. Yeah. Pullman, of course, was the big powerhouse in Chicago during my paper, and they had a remarkable record. But what strikes me, and this becomes very clear in the follow-up chapter to progressive soccer, the one in the 1920s and the chapter that precedes it, is Chicago has a very strong union presence and a labor consciousness presence. And the team that you ends up usurping Pullman are the Bricklayers. And what's unique about them, and I think ONT might have been part of this as well, Tom can clarify this, but it was a labor union team. And in the 1928 Open Cup when they played, I think it was the New York Yankees or the Marksmen. They went by both names at that time, I believe. They played in Soldier's Field in Chicago, and it was a significant labor rally as much as it was a soccer game. And so while there was corporate paternalism, one of the sides that's equally fascinating to me, I think corporate paternalism considered soccer almost as a peripheral endeavor as opposed to other corporate-sponsored sports. And this also allowed, at least in Chicago and to a degree St. Louis, for a union presence in the soccer fields as well.
Yeah, I mean, if I can add, you know, ONT, I believe, although I have no evidence, that the men of ONT or Clark Thread came, you know, to their social and economic superiors and said, we want a soccer team and we also want to play some cricket and some baseball. But soccer eclipsed those other two sports right from the beginning and on through ONT's involvement, which dipped around the turn of the century, and then other teams like the Scots Americans and the Kearney Celtic, these ethnic-based teams were the best in the area. But, you know, kind of feeding off Gabe's dissertation and knowing that there was this big corporate presence on both sides of the river in Newark and then across in Kearney, it really kind of opened up this you know, corporate industrial relations relationship with the men that worked at the mill. And of course, as I end the chapter, there's some labor strife and soccer takes a back seat for a bit. And Clark Thread's teams, you know, go into about a decade-long decline, and then they come back, you know, in 1909, 1910, and challenge for national honors once again. But I think there's a lot of labor history out there for these soccer teams. It's not just showing up on the weekends and playing. There's very much an entwined relationship between work and play.
Very good. I'd like to follow along this line. Just I want to very quickly note that Jim Brown, who played for the Giants and the Skeeters and the Newark Americans, got into a lot of trouble when he was very much welcomed at Manchester United with open arms. But his labor organizing tendencies got him in an awful lot of trouble over there. When he left United, went to Brentford and then Tottenham Hotspur, he was known for being a bit of a radical in terms of the labor force for soccer players. It's another interesting figure from our almost forgotten past. I think Peter is the first in the queue with the comment or question. Peter?
Yeah, more of a comment, somewhat lengthy, so thanks for your patience. I just wanted to say, as an Africanist, how much I learned from these three papers, particularly about the relationship between the local and the national and the history of the global game in the United States. And I really liked the way in which the papers were intertwined with the history of urbanization, of industrialization, of immigration, ethnicity, class, masculine sociability. It really kept me reading. And I was also impressed with how each of the papers did a remarkable job excavating press sources and also, to a certain extent, government documents. This is something that's really lacking in a lot of the journalistic research and work that's done on soccer. And I also thought it was great how they used under-researched published sources, like Gabe with the Spalding Soccer Guide, for instance. So I think most of all, what we're doing tonight, in a lot of ways, I was thinking about this driving over here in the snow, is that we're really at a funeral tonight. But a funeral in the African sense. Funerals in Africa are remarkably celebratory, unlike the culture that I grew up in, which is sort of excessively mournful and tragic. And what I mean is a funeral where we are symbolically, perhaps, burying the Markowitz thesis. Ever since he wrote his Harvard seminar paper in 1986 for the Center of European Studies, and you can find it still online if you're interested in reading the original, this idea that the history of soccer in the U.S. could be explained by resorting to that old chestnut of American exceptionalism has been you know, the master narrative, if you will. And as we all know, his argument, Markowitz's argument, was that after an early entry into the sporting landscape, which is really what two of the three papers focus on, soccer was crowded out of U.S. sports space, whatever that means. I'm not sure what it means. But by the development of the big three and a half, right? Baseball, basketball, gridiron football, and even ice hockey. Then we get his version of this story in the International Journal of the History of Sport in 1990. And then a decade later, it's expanded in Offside, Soccer and American Exceptionalism. But I went back to that 86 paper, and there's a really interesting comment by the person who was the discussant of that paper. It's Professor Meyer from Harvard, a Europeanist. And he basically criticizes Markowitz's thesis right away by saying that, quote, American exceptionalism, like Turner's frontier hypothesis, has been largely a myth. The reason that an American Socialist Party, I'm still quoting here, was weaker than the SPD, but hardly negligible in 1912, was less the absence of a feudal past, this is one of the things that Markowitz builds his case on, right, than the ethnic divisions among recent immigrants. This is on page 3 of Meyer's comments. And I thought, this is exactly what Gabe and Tom and also Stephen are talking about, because the papers are really rich with all these ethnic divisions and identities among mostly white European immigrants covered in exquisite detail. And I love the fact that their historical method, their attention to these details, their constant linking to the local particularity of soccer and society in these places in America played out. And so Tom Cahill and Peter Peel, John Bertos, you know, the William Clarks, and there were two of them, right, in New Jersey, all those things were really a bearing of Mr. Markowitz. And I'm going to close this long intervention. Thank you for your patience. I'm reading a new book, fascinating, James Scott, Two Cheers for Anarchism. Pick it up. It's amazing. It's like the Galeano of history and political science. Page 136, he's talking about in this little vignette, and then I'm going to shut up. He's talking about bringing particularity, flux, and contingency back into the analysis, right? What's missing from Markowitz and the model approach. Quote, what history does to our understanding of events is akin to what a television broadcast does to our understanding of a basketball or ice hockey game. We could say a soccer game. The camera is placed above and outside the plane of action, rather like a helicopter hovering above the action. The effect of this bird's eye view is to distance the viewer from the play and apparently slow it down. Even then, lest the viewer miss a crucial shot or pass, actual slow motion is used to further slow the action and allow the viewer to see it in detail again and again. Combined, the bird's eye perspective and slow motion make the player's moves seem deceptively easy to viewers. Right, you can relate to that. Who might fantasize mastering such moves themselves? Alas, no actual player ever experiences the actual game from a helicopter or in slow motion. And when, rarely, the camera is placed at floor level and close to the action in real time, one finally appreciates the blinding speed and complexity of the game as the players experience it, and the brief fantasy is instantly dispelled. Just like tonight, we are dispelling the Markowitz's thesis. That's my intervention, and I'll pass the ball to the team.
Thank you, Peter. Stephen, I think you're the next with the hand up in the queue.
Great stuff, Peter. Thank you, David. I just forgot to mention something about your question about corporate paternalism. Probably the best example of corporate paternalism in New England, or the best documented, or what you have resources and primary sources, is the involvement of Bethlehem Steel Company in Fall River, the shipyards. There were some Scottish players who were, it was a semi-professional team, of course, but they were making more money from playing soccer than working as industrial workers that had easy jobs as supervisors, foremen, etc. And there are some tremendous resources at the Quincy Public Library about that, and probably that could relate a little bit to Brian Bunk's paper on soccer in Hollywalk. And I should express tremendous thanks to Frank Dalapa, who actually introduced me to the daughter of one of the players, who was able actually to let me know about many things, to show me the field. The Bethlehem Steel Company invested tremendous funds, actually. They built a gym. They built a soccer field. The gym is still there. So that was my little addition that I kind of omitted to mention when you asked this question about corporate patriotism. And the interesting thing is that the American Soccer League actually kind of affected in a bad way the semi-professional teams, because when they kicked off in 1921, ASL teams were offering more money. So the best players from those teams, and there were a couple of them, went to play for the ASL. Thank you.
Brian, I believe you're next in the queue.
Hi, thank you very much. I wanted to make, I guess, two comments, if I can. First, on Peter's comment, I was about to say that I think the best way to understand perhaps the history of soccer in the United States is not to look at it as a kind of a national history, but rather as a local history, or a whole bunch of local histories, as we see here in the papers that we're discussing, and that maybe that fits with the, it's not a bird's eye view, but a kind of a ground level view. And then I guess the question I had about the corporate sponsorship, and I found this to be the case in my own work, which, if people aren't familiar, I looked at the Holyoke Falcos, who were a member, one of the inaugural members of the American Soccer League in 1921, and that was the only year that they played in the league. And they were sponsored or supported by a company called Far Alpaca in Holyoke. And what I found is I could not locate any evidence in the corporate records that have survived or that are available of how or in what ways they actually financed the soccer club. And reading the articles today, I found that to be a similar problem, I guess. And I think that's true also with Roger Alloway's book when he talks about Bethlehem Steel, is that it seems clear that these companies were financing these soccer clubs at various levels, but it's almost impossible to figure out exactly how or how much they were doing it, because I don't know if the corporate records are not available. I mean, Tom is probably more familiar with this than I am, but I forgot until I had read his essay that years ago I had inquired with the Clark Company archives, which I guess are held at the University of Glasgow in Scotland, about whether they had any records, any corporate records for the American branch of the company, and they told, and especially those dealing with the soccer clubs, and they told me that they didn't. So I'm just curious about whether or not people had thought about the availability of these financial records, and if there's a way to put kind of specific figures on how much or how these clubs were financed.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the same problem, Brian. I've written emails and tried to chase down the different branches. You know, most recently had an exchange with Coates, which Clark becomes part of in the 1930s. So it's Coates and Clark, and Coates still exists as a thread manufacturer. And I just got an email today saying, sorry, you know, we weren't able to find anything. And what I was looking for was a, you know, not a diary, but a minutes book of the ONT Athletic Association from the late, you know, 19th century through the early 20th century. I mean, that would have been the dream find for me, because there may well have been membership lists, financial details, other you know, richness there, but it just doesn't exist. And I think we then have to turn to the newspapers to find every little bit that we can to try to flesh out the financial factors. But yeah, it's a real problem.
About the financial factor, but the only sources that I've used and I was able to find is just oral history, daughters, relatives, who claimed that those soccer players were making more money as soccer players. And the interesting thing is that they were training three times per week. Obviously, if you train three times per week during the work week, you won't be able to work as much as an industrial worker. So that they kind of have like jobs that were, you know, they were doing, but, you know, they were not really focused on the industrial jobs. They were playing more soccer. But this is a very, very good question, Brian.
And Brian, if I can add one other thing, you know, with the help of oral history, you can uncover kind of an informal transfer market. Players were moving from, you know, one team to the next, and there are all sorts of hearings and listings in the Spalding guides and in, you know, other formal sources, and then newspaper accounts of this player movement, and sometimes, you know, jobs being offered or money being offered. I have a first-hand account of a gentleman in the late 50s. He comes into the Scots American Club after a match, and the team manager calls him over to the bar where he was sitting, and he says, what do you think about playing for the Newark Germans? He goes, I don't think much of it. I want to stay with the Scots. And he goes, well, I just traded you for $800. And he says, why'd you do that? He goes, I want to go see Celtic play in the European Cup, and I need the money for my airfare. So, you know, all sorts of great little tales of people getting moved and transferred and for sometimes not soccer reasons.
Yeah, I just want to follow up on that too. I've had a lot of questions about that, and that was one of the kind of gold nuggets I was searching for down in the archives, the National Soccer Hall of Fame archives, which are housed at the campus of Eurosport, Nashville, North Carolina. And unfortunately, wasn't able to really come up with much. In particular, I've been really, really curious about Charles Stoneham's ownership of the New York Nationals and the New York Giants. He was also the owner of the New York Giants Major League Baseball team at the time. And when I'd been in contact with Baseball Hall of Fame about that, they didn't know anything about that kind of investment of baseball ownership in professional soccer, knew nothing about it whatsoever. Found a couple documents, but nothing really pointing to the real financials behind that. I've also had similar questions about RKO's ownership of the New York Generals and Madison Square Garden's ownership of the New York Skyliners. And so far, just coming into dead ends with that. Fortunately, I've been able to find a great deal of documents in the past couple months since I became historian of the Cosmos in terms of Warner's financial support for the club's efforts. So, yeah, it's really erratic in terms of what kind of documentation you have with corporate archives. It can be frustrating. And when those oral sources are no longer available when you're dealing with teams from generations ago, it all the more problematic, to be sure. Brenda, I know you had your hand up some time ago, and I do believe you're next in the queue.
Okay, great. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, wonderful. Just like everyone else, I'd like to echo how much I enjoyed these papers. I'm really excited to be able to teach them in my seminars, and I feel like they're really building towards a new chronology, a new narrative that doesn't exist yet in a consecrated fashion, you know, and is in process, and the research is really impressive, and I'm just really looking forward to teaching them and to having these. So thanks to all the authors. I was as a Latin Americanist, I learned a lot, and I was really struck by the relationship with the U.S. labor movement, because it was so similar to what I found in Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. And also what I live here in Queens, because the day laborers have their own leagues here in Queens, and it's become a kind of in the city, and it's become a kind of you know, battle right now over establishing professional soccer here in my neighborhood. So I guess this leads me to a pointed question, which is that I wonder what's at stake in answering the question of why professional soccer is not booming, in the sense of, I guess some of these amateur leagues have done amazing things for public space and unions, and I'm wondering, I guess I'm just wondering what it means to have soccer take off as a professional sport versus sort of some of these earlier histories that show a really vibrant and dynamic amateur life of soccer without a corresponding professional league. I don't know if that's clear. I just want to know what you think, you know, what the authors think is important about this, you know, the problem with under-merchandising, the problem with professional soccer not taking off.
Can I take it quickly?
Sure.
I think at least about Massachusetts, one of the problems was that professional soccer was affected by a couple of semi-professional amateur leagues. Amateur, when I say amateur, people were still getting paid, and they were very strong. And those were Portuguese leagues in the 70s. People just would prefer to go to see their friends at the municipal stadium, and attendance sometimes was like 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 people, and they wouldn't go to the professional games. They would just simply neglect Eusebio in Boston, and they would just watch their friends, have a barbecue after that. And the level of these leagues, of these teams, was pretty good, because during the off season, Portuguese team Benfica and some other big powerhouses would come here. They would play them, and there will be 1-1, 2-1, 3-2, kind of respectable scores. So professional soccer, at least, and it's still affected by some leagues. I can tell you, I saw the Revolution at Foxborough playing in front of 2,000 people during a playoff against Chicago Fire in 08. And there was a Cape Verdean league playing in Rocky Marciano Stadium in Brockton. There were 1,000 people. So 1,000 people. This is 1,000 people that didn't go to the other game. So I would probably say that semi-professional amateur leagues, semi-professional in the 70s and 80s, and amateur leagues nowadays, they kind of affect in some negative way professional soccer or MLS nowadays. And also stuff on TV, of course. Again, if you watch Chelsea, Real Madrid, Barcelona, are you going to watch the New England Revolution or some other teams? I personally would have a hard time. Thank you.
Gabe or Tom, do you want to tackle that great question?
I'll weigh in on it. Brenda, that's an interesting observation. In Chicago, when the Fire debuted in 98, the ownership really went out of its way to draw players from Eastern Europe, a couple Polskis, and a few from Mexico, in the hopes of trying to create this amalgamated team for the various ethnicities of Chicago. And then what was so surprising were several of the native players came up and displace these foreign internationals. Jorge Campos was the goalkeeper, and frankly, Zach Thornton was minding the nets more effectively. And rather than pulling people away or turning people away because of this nationalist aim, because the Fire was winning so much that it filled the stadium, and they've still continued to draw fairly well. So I like what Steve wrote in his work, and how that what happened in Fall River and the amateur leagues drawing so much. And I almost think that I kind of lost my train of thoughts, but I almost think in Chicago there's something similar to that going on, where the ethnic leagues and the regular leagues are drawing quite a bit more. But if the team puts out a winning team, then the fans tend to come, regardless of who's on the pitch.
Tom,
I would chime in and say, I think MLS is quite healthy right now, and you know, entering its 18th year this Saturday. You have to remember that the Bundesliga is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, and that's probably the model for MLS to copy in terms of, you know, fiscal responsibility, development of players, excitement of the games, the fan experience. I mean, that's the league that I would turn to in all sorts of ways. So then you have another three decades to go along. But the other thing, I think that there's been no real pro continuum from the old ASL. Then the ethnic leagues took over. It was, as was noted, the NASL obviously came along in the 70s and died in the 80s. Then there was a lost generation. And then here we are at MLS. The only real continuum are these ethnic leagues, some of them that are semi-professional. And, you know, the immigrant experience has always been here. And, you know, this country is constantly renewing itself with immigration. So it logically will always be here in the future. So I think to draw on those newcomers and pull them into the American soccer family is going to be real important to continue to grow this game. And I think that's happening more in this era than in previous eras.
I think one other example of that, a lot of people like to think that the Cosmos success was all about the signing of Pelé and then the signing of Beckenbauer and Quinalha and Carlos Alberto and other global superstars. But the seeds for the club's success were really sown in its early years when Clive Toy and Gordon Bradley reached out to those ethnic clubs that were already existing. In particular, the German-American Soccer League, housed essentially in your Queens. They did a great job of networking with those ethnic soccer clubs that were in place, to the degree that the German-American Soccer League eventually rebranded to the Cosmopolitan Soccer League in homage to the Cosmos. That gesture really speaks to the strong relationship that they had between them. And what, you know, so many of the players on those early Cosmos sides, especially that the NASL championship team in 1972, came from the local ethnic leagues, players like Werner Roth, of course. So that was something that the Cosmos did very effectively, but we haven't seen in subsequent iterations, I don't think, in terms of making those strong connections with the ethnic leagues and tying them in with the structure of the top flight pro teams. David, I believe you had a question. David Keyes? Hello, David?
Maybe we can come back to him.
Okay, I can't hear you. David, can you hear me? Okay. I suppose we can move on to another question. We've talked about Tom, I really like that phrase that there's no real pro continuum. At key moments in those lapses of those great leagues, the two golden days phases, the American Soccer League and the North American Soccer League, William Maley of Glasgow Celtic spoke before the USSF annual general meeting in 1931 and talked about the top flight ignoring the minnows. Clive Toy, in many ways, echoed the very same sentiment in 1985 when the NASL had seen its demise. And so now I'm wondering what connections others may see between the gap between the top flight teams existing now or in the past. I did talk about the Cosmos attempts to integrate with the minnows throughout the New York area. But those were strong words from William Maley of Celtic in 1931 and strong words from Clive Toy in 1985 for a real integration of the game from not just a top flight level. And we're hearing some talk of Major League versus Minor League soccer, the baseball structure of the sport, as opposed to the true pyramidal structure of the game as it's played around the rest of the world. I wondered especially what our three authors would say about the notion of an American soccer pyramid, or lack thereof.
Yeah, I'd like to weigh in on that. In the Midwest, Well, the ASL went through its various incarnations after the 1920s and then again in the 30s, and it was kind of hard to define what it was, the ASL2 and the ASL3. There was the North American Soccer Football League that started right after World War II, and it was a professional circuit that drew out of the Midwest, and it was kind of unique in that it pulled out the top players from the ethnic communities. And so while there wasn't a continuing professional league per se that went year after year after year, in the Midwest anyway, and I think this is a bit of an anomaly, about every 10 years there seems to be another professional league that linked all these cities for about 2 or 3 years. Most of you are probably familiar with Gil Heron, who came out of that league. Okay.
Others on that question regarding the American soccer pyramid or lack thereof?
Well, I mean, this is Tom. You have, different images, analogies, metaphors here. You know, I like to use the American soccer pie and how it gets cut up in so many different ways. If we're using a contemporary example with, all sorts of youth soccer through the professional soccer, I mean, that's one pyramid, right? You know, the chronological pyramid from the youngest ages all the way up to the professional game. And sometimes there isn't enough time in the day or in the weekend to go to a youth game, then maybe playing a men's game, and then, go to a pro game, at night. It's difficult to just have access to the time. And then, of course, there's the cost factor. As a kind of middle class sport, in much of the country, it is pay for play, which is unlike much of the rest of the world. So, access to the game is an issue. But I see a lot of competing interests, and one of the things that I think we need to address is this issue of money. Soccer now makes money in this country, and there can be good and negative consequences along with those profit margins.
Just a quick follow-up. This is Steve. Is there a pyramid? What is the pyramid? No matter how good or bad the teams are, they're still on the top. I think this is probably something that kind of protected MLS, because otherwise it would have gone down big time. And following just quickly with the last comment, very few of the teams make money, actually. The teams that make money is the Seattle Sounders, Toronto, and the LA Galaxy. And really, this single entity of MLS, that's what it preserves the league. Just to finish, if communism exists in the United States, it does in soccer, because MLS is a soccer communist league. The revenue is shared no matter how good or bad you are. Thank you.
Well, that league structure, of course, is preserved in large part on the model of scarcity of franchises. Right, and so protecting against the pyramid serves that socialized model's interests, of course. Andrew Guest, I know you have a question, but first I want to read David Keyes' question since he's having an audio problem. And I quote, my question is as follows. I'm curious to what degree the leagues discussed in these papers made any effort to have youth programs. One of the main changes that I see in the post-World War II period in the U.S. is the growth of youth soccer. Unless I'm missing something in their papers, I'm wondering, A, if I have missed youth programs, to what degree the authors think the base of the pyramid that exists now in terms of youth soccer will shape the future of professional soccer in the U.S.? He then says, whoops, that wasn't quite finished, but I'd like to first of all turn to Gabe. Gabe Logan, you addressed youth soccer in Chicago in an important passage in your chapter.
Right, and the professional and semi-professional teams nurtured their own youth clubs. I've especially looked at Mayor Cermak in the 1930s, who kind of had this idea that if we can't keep the American-born kids in the Czech community via the tradition, then we can do it through sport. And so the Czech clubs in America would play soccer, but they would also play, in Chicago rather, would play soccer, but they would also play baseball and basketball and the other sports, and the idea that they would keep the children in the ethnic community. But this goes on beyond the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, where most any premier, any first division team in Chicago also had a youth team. In fact, in 1920, the famous Open Cup where the St. Louis Ben Millers played Fall River, and the St. Louis Ben Millers was all native born. What's interesting was the team they had to beat to get to the Open Cup was the Chicago side that was also native born. So in 1920, we have our first full 22 players out there are playing in the semis for the Open Cup, and they're all native born. This has been usurped a lot by the public schools taking over the soccer programs. And again, I look at Peter Peel, this soccer father in Chicago. And in addition to the Peel Cup, he also gave the Peel Shield, which was a youth tournament, and I believe it began in 1906, and it's still played for today. And I believe it's the oldest high school team sport trophy that's still being played for, and that's pretty much held between the Chicago public schools and the city.
I was dropped there for a little bit. This is Tom again. I believe we're talking about youth soccer, correct?
Correct. Correct. Yes. Yes. I'm just elaborating on the continuation of the youth soccer in Chicago from the past to the present.
I could add a little bit there. I believe this is David's question. There is evidence of early youth soccer on a number of levels in Kearney and Harrison and Newark. And it goes back to mostly the early 1900s, where they're playing in the schools as part of the playground movement. In 1905, 1906, the Newark public school system has soccer after school at the local parks. And then the clubs started pushing youth soccer down. So they had the first team, they had a second team, then they had age group teams, like a junior, there was the West Hutchin Junior Soccer League. And then beneath that, they had like U14 leagues. I didn't find any evidence of 9 and 10 and 11-year-olds playing like we see today. But I do have some pretty interesting evidence of kids playing sandlot soccer, just like they would be playing sandlot baseball. They used some of the empty lots around the factories to play pickup game or street soccer. So in the first decade or so of the 20th century, there is evidence of that. I would love to find out more about this. I bet it's, you know, very much informal soccer, which is one of the best ways to learn the game.
Andrew, I know you've got a question, but quick, I just want to follow up with Gabe. You had mentioned a really interesting passage in your paper about the schoolyard soccer, or the playground movement. I'm not sure of the exact term that you used, and that it was kind of short-lived, it sounds like due to funding or something like that, which of course raises the other question now in terms of the turf wars that soccer has to wrestle with other sports, especially those that are perceived as more indigenous, like baseball or gridiron football, or even now lacrosse, the constant turf wars for access. Doesn't seem like access of space was the problem there, but maybe funding. Could you speak a little bit about that youth movement and how that really kind of served as a melting pot for the Chicago kids, where it wasn't really ethnically based?
Sure. This was part of the playground movement that came out of the Hull House. and one of the early proponents of the playground movement was this guy from the East Coast, and I can't remember his name right now, but he was a soccer player. And when he came to Chicago, and he was a resident of Hull House, and the playground movement began to expand around Hull House, and from there it went into the South City parks, which were the suburbs of Chicago at the time. He implemented soccer along with the other sports, and unlike the other sports, there wasn't, as you said, a turf battle, and so people could play soccer in the parks, and this really engendered a youth movement for the youth soccer players. And they were not done by age, but by weight classification, which I thought was odd. And also there was a proliferation of the women's game in Chicago in the 20s and 30s in the South Park districts. And they allowed for these inter-ethnic female clubs to participate against each other and with the public schools. And this is another little nugget that's waiting to be researched in terms of the history of the female game in the city.
Andrew, would you like to go forward with your question now?
Sure. My question is unrelated to MLS, but I made a comment about the MLS, and I think I agree more with Tom than with Stephen on the viability of MLS. I mean, I think looking at the franchise, at the how much money the teams claim to make is a bit of a problematic way to look at it. I mean, most American professional teams in the NBA and NFL and baseball, they claim to lose money, but that's mostly because it's a tax write-off for the owners, and they, you know, the thing is that the MLS franchise costs have actually been going up significantly, and there's a lot of people willing to pay them. There's a lot of problems with MLS, but I think it's actually I think it's doing okay. I think Sepp Blatter was a bit out of line to say it's made no progress whatsoever, but that's sort of a side note. And again, I'm biased because I enjoy going to my Portland Timbers games, and I think there's quite a good atmosphere there. And the question I had actually builds off what you guys are talking about now and David's question on youth development. And my question is about the sort of school soccer piece, which Gabe just addressed some, and that was interesting to hear. The one part of Markowitz's argument in American exceptionalism that I've always kind of bought, although I know there's some other things that are a bit specious, is that, one thing that happened was that colleges in particular and high schools also in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when the sports scene in the U.S. was really being sorted out, opted for, again, American football and also basketball and as opposed to soccer, and that has had a big trickle-down effect, because in the United States, unlike Europe, colleges and high schools really represent communities, whereas in Europe or other parts of the world, professional teams, professional sports clubs, or I should say just sports clubs generally, sort of represent communities. And so I've always sort of bought that, and particularly, and you know, in recent years, that's obviously changed, but a lot of that, I think, is related to Title IX, the massive increase of girls' high school soccer. Obviously, there's now tension between high school soccer and club soccer. But I'm just sort of curious, particularly, again, the Chicago paper was really interesting about the brief proliferation of team soccer. But my sense, and especially in relation to the playground movement, is that it was less of a kind of a community identity, competitive interscholastic thing than a sort of an outlet, like somebody was saying, sort of after school on the playgrounds. But I guess I'd be curious generally how people in each of the three very interesting cases saw the role of school soccer as part of the, kind of, at least in a popular sense, marginalization of soccer as an American game.
I'd like to briefly weigh in on that. That's in my research, Andrew. I came across, I thought after Harvard elected to play the American football game, that soccer kind of went into this netherworld out on the East Coast. But then again, I think it was 1905 that there was intercollegiate soccer going on in Illinois. And I'm also was able to trace several of these high school players that went to University of Illinois that also had an early soccer team, and they continued their career there, and then from there went back to Chicago and began playing in the adult leagues. There's not many examples of that, but there are a couple that did happen, and again, we're looking at 100 years back. I don't know how it would relate to today.
In the towns, this is Tom again, in the towns that I looked at, you know, one's a major city, over 300,000 people in Newark in the first part of the 20th century. And then, you know, these smaller, you know, cross river towns that really were just kind of part of Newark in some ways. High school soccer comes into the picture very haphazardly in 1905, 1906 after the Corinthians tour, and then it goes away, but then it comes back for real in the post-World War I era for Kearney, I think it was 1921, Harrison 1922, Newark Schools 22, 23. And interestingly, both Kearney and Harrison didn't have American football teams for some time. And it took Harrison quite a long time to have an American football team. Obviously, when they did, kind of took off. But the rivalry between Harrison High and Kearney High, they played twice a year, once on Election Day and then once on Thanksgiving Day. And these games were attended 4,000 or 5,000 people. They actually had to stop the rivalry at one point because of the hostility both on the field and on the sidelines. So there is early evidence of high school soccer and quite competitive and fierce matches.
Stephen, what about Massachusetts and school soccer?
Well, there's actually again at the shipyards of Quincy. There was a men's team and there was also a junior team. But then again, the sources are very limited. So it's newspapers or a little bit in the archives of at the Quincy Public Library. So it's kind of very difficult to talk about the beginning of the century. I believe there is a fellow who is doing this at the Montfort University who is a American. His Gabe actually has exchanged some emails with him, and he kind of compares youth soccer in the United States, France, and England, if I'm not wrong. Is this correct, Gabe?
It is correct, yes. England and France.
England and France?
Right, but I don't think France made it to the – I think it got chopped in the editing block.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that. So that's a very good question. There is evidence, but
Stephen, your connection is weak.
Can you hear me now?
That's much better, Stephen. Yes.
Okay. Do you want me to repeat that?
Yeah, the last couple sentences I think we missed out on.
I said that there are very few courses, and it's a very good question. To provide a lot of answers from Hello?
Okay. I think we heard you there. Well, one reason that we turn to history, of course, is to learn from it for the better future. So, I'd like to ask the three historians whose papers we've read in anticipation of tonight, if you wanted to put on the prophetic cap for a moment, and where do you see the game in the United States in the next 10, 15, 20 years?
This is Gabe. I hate to try to predict the future. However, Soccer has done nothing but gotten more popular in the United States, and I don't see any reason why that trend should discontinue.
Tom? Steven?
Yeah, this is Tom. And there's that famous quote, you know, soccer is the future of American sport and will always remain that way. But I think we're, you know, not necessarily the dawn of a new age, but to echo Gabe's comments, just year by year progress makes me quite optimistic about the future of soccer on all sorts of levels, from the littlest people, you know, enjoying the game, all the way up through the professional. I'm quite optimistic and positive that it will continue to grow and prosper.
At this point of the conversation, we experienced technical problems. About 3 minutes are missing from the recording.
I wonder any of the three of you would care to address what I would consider to be the elephant in the room for U.S. soccer, the fact that the most popular team in the country is the Mexican national team, and how easy it is for us to follow on television the Mexican national team as it pursues its place in the next World Cup, whereas so many are unable to watch the U.S. national team's away games. We had a session on the Mexican national team and its support in the States right now. But I wondered if the three of you would have any thoughts on, in particular, an historical perspective of the emergence of the U.S. national team as being worthy of consideration of American soccer fans, but its continuing struggle for relevance. Especially as we attempt World Cup qualification.
I'm going to think about that one and let my colleagues go ahead first, please.
Tom or Steve, care to chime in on that?
It's a pretty good question. It's very interesting. Just to add an extra thing that the U.S. national team and the Mexican teams are marketed by the same organization, and the U.S. soccer actually it's kind of successful because of Mexican soccer, because a lot of Mexican games are played in the United States. Tickets are more expensive, and this is shared with U.S. soccer. So that's something pretty interesting and unique, I think, in that respect.
You know, David, Steve and I had this conversation last year, and I remember when the early World Cups were going on, 88 and 90, that were being televised in the United States, and 88, 94, all the way up to the present. And it hasn't been until probably the last 5 years that myself and my friends would prefer to watch soccer on the Mexican channel, because it was such a much more livelier telecast and there weren't the confounded commercials going on or the inane camera work with the ball that one would often find on United States television trying to cover the games. And I think that had a lot to do with certainly bringing an awareness of the Mexican national team at a young age.
It seems we've just been joined by someone in Buenos Aires. Alex, hello.
Hi, everyone. I'm a bit jet-lagged to participate much, but it's nice just to pop in and say hi.
I trust you had a safe journey.
Safe and uneventful.
Well, again, I bring up this issue of the U.S. National team and the lack of popularity, and many people like to thump the chest about the victory over the English national team. But, of course, the 1930 World Cup, the United States had a very good showing, third place. That's something we tend to forget, and it was no fluke that we were able to field such a side. Bob Millar, the leader of that squad, a great, great legend here in New York soccer circles when we played at Uruguay. That was a team of professionals from the American Soccer League, and we represented ourselves well. So it's not a matter of finding our first footing on the international stage. It's really restoring that footing that we did have back in 1930, in no small part thanks to the American Soccer League. And I think that all three of these papers do a real wonderful, wonderful job of shedding light on that rich, rich sporting past, that oft-neglected, all-too-fragmented history of American soccer. It's scholarships such as this that really, I think, will enrich the game in many ways for years to come, because, as we all know, soccer is all about passion, and a sense of legacy deepens that sense of passion. I know we have just a couple minutes left. Traditionally, these sessions last a full 90 minutes, and I don't want to push it to extra time for selfish reasons. I have a 10 o'clock kickoff. But I do want to say that Roger Alloway had hoped to be with us tonight, but he had another commitment for a class that he had to attend. But he wanted to send our all of the participants his warm wishes. I think it's no exaggeration to say that Roger Alloway is the godfather of American soccer history. So he sends his best wishes to everyone. And also, I'd just like to note that David Wangerin has done so much, contributed so much to this field. The loss of David Wangerin is something that many of us in American soccer history circles will lament for a long, long time to come. But fortunately, his great book, Soccer in a Football World and Distant Corners, are touchstone pieces of scholarship that we can all turn to. In our closing 120 seconds, is there any brief concluding thoughts anyone would like to share?
Yeah, I have a brief concluding thought. It's so infrequent that I get a chance to talk about academic and soccer, and I certainly do appreciate this venue, and Peter, especially to you for putting this together. So hats off to you all, and I look forward to joining future conferences.
Something very quickly, I spoke about this with David and briefly with Gabe. Anybody interested in going to Carolina for a couple of days, a few people just to go through the archives, this could be relevating, you know, for a lot of people.
It really is like that final scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, when the Ark of the Covenant is boxed up and put in a warehouse. That is the state of the archives of the National Soccer Hall of Fame, and I do hope that we'll find a more accessible home for them in the near future. But it's quite astounding, having been down there this past summer, the way in which such treasures are boxed up right now. I think it'll take scholarly efforts persistent scholarly efforts to really unearth so many of those treasures that are boxed away in Carolina right now. And yes, I do hope, Stephen, many of the scholars in the Football Scholars Forum will join in that effort.
Thank you. Let's keep in touch about that. Tell me whatever it's going to be convenient for you. I'm totally for, and just let me know. I would like to join just to go there and explore for a couple of days.
Anyone else, any other concluding thoughts? Or should we call it full time?
Tom, any final thoughts?
No, just thanks for the forum and the platform to share our stories and our ideas, and look forward to checking back in over time.
Well, thank you, everyone. And with that, I think we'll call it three blows of the whistle. And thanks again, especially to Stephen, Tom, and Gabe for their wonderful papers and their wonderful insights tonight. And thank you for everyone who's joined in the conversation.
And thanks, David, for moderating. It was difficult with so many people participating. You did a great job.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right. We'll see you all soon. And Alex, we'll be in touch. Thanks very much, everyone, and good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Signing off.